since I've been here for service on a Wednesday evening. Just trying to think, it's probably been something like 25 years or more. I don't know. But I suspect it's been somewhere in that vicinity. It's good to be here. It's good to see all of you. This has been on my mind, I think, since May. It's when I was first asked to do this. Been a lot of other things on my mind as well, but I trust that we can have a profitable evening together here. How do you approach a subject like mental illness, and how should the church respond to someone who is suffering from a mental illness? I'm not sure that I have the answers yet, but I thought about this, and I thought about it a lot, and I think I'm going to start with a little drama just to illustrate a point. So I've drafted James here, and he's going to have a heart attack. So James, go ahead and put your head over there so people can see you instead of behind the pulpit here. Oh, he doesn't look so good. Wonder what happened to him. I'm going to turn the other mic on. If I can. Yeah, come on here. Technology is nice if it works. All right, I think I'm on now. Now how's that? Okay, he doesn't look very good. He's twitching. He's awful pale. I wonder what's going on with him. Let's see. Are you having any pain, or what's going on with you? He's not responding. He's got a very weak pulse. I wonder what his blood pressure is. You know, if I didn't know better, I'd think he was having a heart attack. What do you think we should do for him? What should we do first? Well, I think maybe we should turn to the Bible and see what the Bible has to say about hearts and heart attacks and things like that. You know, in Genesis 6:5 it said, "And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." You know, I really think we should do something for him. In Jeremiah 17:9 it says, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" You know, I think he's going to die if we don't do something. I wonder if we shouldn't maybe do a little CPR or something like that. He just doesn't look good at all. Let's see, what does Ephesians have to say about the heart? "Having the understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them because of the blindness of their heart." And Ephesians 6:22 also says, "Whom I have sent unto you for the same purpose, that you might know our affairs, and that he might comfort your hearts." Well, I think he really needs some comforting. All right, you can get up now. Glad it wasn't real. Thank you, Joseph. Well, we're really not talking about heart attacks tonight. We're talking about mental illness. And the point I want to make, and I hope you've already figured this out, that those who are suffering from mental illness, so many times the thought is well-intentioned, well-meaning, but the thought amongst our people is there must be something sinful in that person's life. I wonder what that person is hiding. And I want to tell you, that is not necessarily true. Now, I don't want to discount what sin can do in our lives. And I also don't want to discount what having that sin question taken care of, what that can do in our lives as well. But for us to just make a blank assessment or a blank acceptance of the fact that the person who is suffering from mental illness has got to have some kind of sin hidden in their life. That is wrong. Now, I would like to say, first of all, the church is not a showcase for saints. I mean, yes, there are saints here, and we hope that we can all be among the saints, but the church is a hospital for sinners. We were all sinners before we became part of the church. The Bible tells us that all have come short of the glory of God. All have sinned, and there's no escaping it. If we tell ourselves that we don't have any sin, we're kidding ourselves. So all of us need to deal with the sin question. And the only way that it can be dealt with effectively is through the blood of Jesus Christ. Now that said, I want to make it plain again that just because someone is suffering from a mental illness does not mean that there is sin in their lives. I remember one time, it was within the first number of years that we were married, Carol was having a significant depressive episode, and I happened to meet one of the sisters in the church in town. She wanted to know how Carol was doing, and I don't remember just the specifics of the conversation, but the one thing I do remember that she said was that, well, just tell her to take it to the Lord and leave it there. Well, friends, let me tell you something. If anybody in our family should have been depressed, it should have been me, because Carol prayed and prayed and prayed much more than I did. But like she said, it seemed like her prayers only went to the ceiling and didn't go any further than that. I also remember, many years ago when I was still a teenager, I learned to know a family in northern Indiana. I think when I was 15, I got a chance to go with them to Holmes County, Ohio, and visit my uncle and lived there. Later on, I learned to know their children and ran around some with their children as well. But she had some problem with depression, and she told me one time when she was having a bad time, she said, "I knew I was lost. There was absolutely no hope for me whatsoever. I knew I was lost." Now, can you imagine living believing that? Now, maybe it was Satan telling her, but maybe she was sick. Maybe she had a sick mind. In fact, she was to the point where she ended up having to have electroconvulsive therapy. And she told me, after the depression was taken care of, then she could have hope in Jesus Christ again. Now, those are some of the things that some of these mental illnesses will do for you. I want to give you some information. All the information that I've got is readily available. All you have to do is Google it if you have internet access. But there's three things that I want to talk about. First of all, schizophrenia, which I think is probably not as common in our circles as some of the other mental illnesses are. Then I want to talk about depression. And last, I want to talk about bipolar depression. Bipolar is sometimes called manic depressive syndrome or manic depressive disorder. It can be right unhandy. All of these illnesses are unhandy, but I think the bipolar is undoubtedly the worst, because one day the patient may be up here and so manic and so excited. And I know of a case, a man who was bipolar, and when he was high, he talked his banker into lending him $500,000 to start buying and selling cars. I mean, you know, and one of the problems with manic depressives is that when they are high, they don't want to come down. I mean, they're terribly creative and, you know, their brain is just racing and they can get all kinds of things accomplished. But anyway, that's not the story either. All right, 10 signs of schizophrenia. First of all, we see withdrawal. Social withdrawal is common to those suffering from schizophrenia. For example, a once social and friendly individual may suddenly seek isolation and become very suspicious and paranoid of the intentions of others. Sometimes schizophrenia are called, I don't know how good this, is it effective? I'm going to have to sit down here just a minute because I've got some back issues, and that's why I brought my little high chair along. People who are normally sociable and outgoing and so on, all of a sudden withdraw, well, there may be something wrong. There may be any number of things, but this is one of the first signs of schizophrenia. Another one, the second one, is a lack of emotions. This is a lack of, however, we can understand how you may shrug this off as a typical apathetic teenage response. The individual may be unable to express feelings of joy, be totally unable to cry, or they may experience the opposite, where they don't stop crying or laughing uncontrollably. Their whole demeanor may appear indifferent to what would be a normally stressful or emotional situation, even their gaze expressionless when asked a question or for an opinion. So that's, you know, someone who is normally at least responds appropriately to emotional situations and so on, someone who that turns off, well, that may be another sign of a problem. Insomnia is a big thing, especially with a number of these mental illnesses that we want to talk about. It's common for those experiencing the early stages of schizophrenia to be unable to sleep through the night. In fact, you may find them up reading, watching television, or on the computer all hours of the night because they are frustrated and cannot sleep. And that is so frustrating when you cannot go to sleep. This insomnia will lead to excessive fatigue and inability to focus, and an attribute to a sudden apathetic attitude about life in general. So, you know what it feels like when you go to bed late and get up early. Well, imagine what it's like if you can't sleep at all. Or sometimes what happens, the patient may be able to fall asleep, but then wakes up very early and cannot stay asleep, cannot go back to sleep. That's so frustrating. You know, everybody else is sleeping peacefully, and here I am, I can't sleep. I've had some problem with that because of my back, where just enough discomfort, just enough pain, where I couldn't go to sleep. So usually what I'll end up doing is go out and sit on my recliner, and somehow or other, that often works, but not always. If you will bear with me. Another example or another symptom of schizophrenia is unexplained hostility. Now, you might have some unexplained hospitality with somebody that's manic depressive, but in their manic phase, but otherwise, unexplained hostility. And you know, at sometimes is normal response for teenagers. I hope yours don't do that or didn't do that. But, you know, teenagers, adolescents, they have a problem, have enough trouble finding their way the way it is. And sometimes they get hostile. And but it could also be an indication of a deeper problem. So you've got this fastidious young man who always cleans himself up, takes a shower every day, shaves at least 3 times a week, and wouldn't wear the same pair of pants and shirt for more than one day. All of a sudden, this person starts just not caring about how they look. They don't take care of themselves and so on. Again, this is a sign or could be a sign of some deeper problems. Okay, now, you know, there's one reason they call us Mennonites, because there's so many nights that we don't stay at home. And you know how that is with our young folks? But what if all of a sudden they just decide they don't want to go? They don't want to go to the volleyball game. They don't want to go to the social. They don't want to have anything to do with other people. So on. Here again, that's a sign, or could be a sign, of something deeper than just normal whatever. Now, here's a big one. Sensitivity to light and noise. It seems, I really don't know that much about schizophrenia myself, but it seems that one of the things, or one of the characteristics of schizophrenics, is that they are almost bombarded with more stimuli than they can handle. And so they become especially sensitive to light and noise. This person who normally likes to listen to music and cheerful and outgoing and so on, and all of a sudden stops playing their music, listening to music, that kind of thing, can't stand the noise of the family being together and so on, could be a sign of a deeper problem. And here's something else that could be very alarming, and that is self-inflicted harm. In my career as a nurse, and especially when I was working in the burn center, saw at least one patient who would cut herself. She would put lye on herself to burn her skin. Those kinds of things. There's one especially notable one that I recall, and that was in the early years. When I was working in the burn center. So that's been probably 28 years ago, but I remember very vividly that patient. So self-inflicted harm, probably a indication of some serious problems there. The ninth one is escapism. People who normally are outgoing and so on, and who just tend to escape, want to get away from everything, don't want to be involved with anything, so on. Again, sign of a problem. And then last but certainly not least is a recoil from human contact. They don't want to have anything to do. They don't want to shake hands with anybody. They don't want any hugs. They don't want to have any contact with people at all. That could be a sign of some serious problems as well. Now, depression is something that I probably know more about than most other mental illnesses, and that's not to say that I'm an expert, because I've probably forgotten 2/3 or more of what I knew, but I got some on-the-job training for that. Carol has had problems with depression since she was an adolescent, which is an indication to me, in looking back, and they say hindsight is 20/20. But in looking back, that indicates to me that there probably was a hormonal component to her depression. And many times when women are going through menopause, they have hot flashes and so on, they can also become very depressed. And sometimes hormone replacement therapy will help those people. And we know that indeed has helped Carol. Between an internal medicine doctor and a psychiatrist that Carol's seen for quite a number of years, basically, we have a life back. I tell you, it can be very, very difficult to live with someone who is depressed. And that doesn't mean to say that I'm always easy to live with either. I've got my fault. And I'll just tell you, quite frankly, I had my own depressed episode. Most of the summer, I was very depressed. I didn't realize how bad it was. And I think it was a combination of some external factors, but I also think that I hadn't realized up to that point how much Carol's depression had affected me. Depression can be very, very corrosive to relationships. And it's not something to trifle with. Let's see. The point I was trying to make, there's another point I was trying to make with my little drama here. That is, when I said, if we don't do something, he's probably going to die. Well, that can be true with a depressed person too. Not that they would die of natural causes, but unfortunately suicide is, I don't want to say often, but suicide is a result of depression. So it's serious business, people. It's not something that you want to trifle with. Any number of people that, or stories that could be related, but one especially that I remember, a lady who was depressed and her husband was doing everything that he could to protect her. You know, all knives were out of the house, everything out of the house, the doors were locked, and so on, but he went to sleep. And he found his wife in the chicken house, hanged herself. So depression is very serious. It's not something to trifle with. It's something that we need to take seriously, and we need to get treatment. Now, I don't want to discount or poo-poo or whatever the term is that one would use to counseling. I think biblical counseling can be very effective in some cases. But when we're dealing with a depression, what we call clinical depression, where the patient is no longer able to function and has suicidal thoughts and those kinds of things, we need professional help. I remember one time, while I was still working at St. Francis, which has been quite a few years ago already, Carol called me one afternoon. It was about 2:30. I was supposed to work until 7 that evening. And she said, "This is the worst day I've ever had," and promptly burst into tears. Well, I asked her what the problem was, and I don't remember what all the conversation was, but I told her, "I will be home as quickly as I can." I told the boss, I said, "I've got to go home. I've got to go home and take care of my wife." And they very graciously got somebody to take over my patients. I was able to leave and go home. And Carol had just about reached the point of being non-functional. Thankfully, that's not the case anymore. I think it was on that occasion that, and for people who are depressed, being outside in bright sunlight can be very beneficial. So we had some grass to cut, and we had gotten a new Honda walk-behind mower, you know, self-propelled, one of those really nice ones, as nice as a walk-behind can be. And I decided that I'm going to help her, and I'm going to get her to cut grass. It was interesting to me to observe how initially she couldn't coordinate the controls. You know, you have to put in the blade clutch first, then you have to pull on this lever behind the handlebars, and that makes it go, that, you know, that's the clutch, and so on. Initially, she couldn't coordinate that very well, but the longer she was at it, of course, practice makes perfect, but still, the longer she was at it, the longer she was outside in the sunlight, the better she became at it. So that can be very helpful to people who are depressed. And in fact, people who are mildly depressed, they recommend light boxes. Full spectrum lights they recommend for people who are mildly depressed. That can be very helpful. And I know that you're aware of the work that's being done in Canada with Native Americans and so on. You know that the suicide rate among Native Americans is very high compared to other societies. And one of the reasons they feel is because of the long nights. Now, we were up north this summer when we had some long days, and that was pretty nice. But can you imagine it being dark for, say, 22 hours a day? I can't imagine that. But They feel like that is certainly a contributing factor to the high suicide rate among Native Americans. All right. Here are some of the signs and symptoms of depression. Well, let's talk about the different forms that depression takes sometimes. First one they call persistent depressive disorder. It's also called dysthymia. It is a depressed mood that lasts for at least 2 years. Now, it's not full-blown depression. You just can't get it together. Now, I think it would be a good thing at this point to differentiate between depression and discouragement. Any of you read the letter from Auburn, Kentucky, written by Jerry Yoder in the budget? Well, yeah, I know that some of you do. You know who I'm talking about. Well, Jerry described it to me very, very succinctly. He said, discouragement is when you have so many bills to pay and there's so little money. That's really discouraging. He said, depression is when the banker calls you and tells you that not only do you have all these bills to pay, but you're overdrawn already. Now, I think that describes pretty succinctly the difference between discouragement and depression. I have a poem that I want to read a little later about depression as well. There is perinatal depression. A lot of women get postpartum depression or perinatal depression. They get depressed after their babies are born. And that is because the hormones in their system are recalibrating and readjusting themselves to a normal state again. You know, it takes high levels of some hormones to maintain a pregnancy and so on. And so it's quite a circus going on in their bodies. So there's that. There's a psychotic depression, and this occurs when a person has severe depression plus some form of psychosis, such as having disturbing false fixed beliefs or delusions, or hearing or seeing upsetting things that others cannot hear or see, like hallucinations. The psychotic symptoms typically have a depressive theme, such as delusions of guilt, poverty, or illness. Then there's seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. And that is people who become depressed in the wintertime when the days get short, but when spring comes back and the days start getting longer, then the depression seems to lift. And for those people especially, light therapy seems to work quite well. And of course, then there's bipolar depression, which we will talk about a little bit more later. Some of the signs and symptoms of depression. By the way, when am I supposed to stop? 8:30? Yeah, better gas it. Signs and symptoms of depression. There's a persistent, sad, anxious, or empty mood. Feelings of hopelessness or pessimism. You know, there's just no hope. Things will not ever get any better. And there's irritability. Now, that was the biggest manifestation that I had. Although, I went to see the doctor soon after it was probably a month or 2 months after all this, my own episode started. And, of course, he always asked me, well, anything new going on in your life? And I said, yeah, I think I'm depressed. And he said, well, what makes you think you're depressed? And I said, well, I hope I can get through this without crying, and promptly burst into tears. Now, I'm not the kind of person that wears my feelings on my sleeve, but and I find as I get older that I am more emotional, and I find it much easier to shed tears, especially for others. But that time, it was for my own pain and for my own whatever. So I did have that one episode. There was one day when I cried all the way to work, and I was working at Galicia at that point, and something had happened in the morning before I left. I usually left home about, a few minutes before 10 o'clock because I worked from 11 to 11, and something had set it off, and I tell you, I cried the whole way, all 50 miles to work. I can't tell you why, but I did. But irritability was my biggest symptom, and I think if you ask Carol, she would tell you that I was not easy to live with. There are feelings of guilt, worthlessness, or helplessness. Those are very typical. There's a loss of interest or pleasure in hobbies and activities. There's decreased energy or fatigue. Sometimes the person who is clinically depressed or seriously depressed can't hardly get one foot in front of the other. That's how tired and fatigued they are. Moving or talking more slowly. You know, their thought processes are slowed down. And so they speak more slowly. They just, here again, it's a situation where you just can't get it together. There are feelings of restlessness or having trouble sitting still. And that kind of goes back to irritability. But, you know, there's always something. Carol would describe it as her mind was just whirling. And, you know, that can be very disturbing. There's difficulty concentrating, remembering, or making decisions. That's often difficult for people who are depressed. There's difficulty sleeping, early morning awakening, or oversleeping, and appetite or weight changes. Carol certainly had periods of insomnia. I remember one time she hadn't slept in two nights, and so on the third day, I finally called the doctor, the psychiatrist that she was seeing, made a special trip to the pharmacy in Wichita. We were living southeast of Haven at the time. Made a special trip to the pharmacy in Wichita to pick up a prescription so that she would be able to sleep that night. Well, of course, so she took whatever it was that the doctor had prescribed and went to bed. Well, we both went to bed at the same time. She went to sleep. I was the one that couldn't sleep. So finally I got up because I didn't want to disturb her sleep with my tossing and turning, and I went out and slept on the couch after I was finally able to go to sleep. Well, the next morning I woke up fairly early. It was in the summertime, but it was just gray dawn, just enough where you could see without a light. And I looked in the bedroom door, and I mean, she was laying there perfectly still. And the first thing that went through my mind, that medicine killed her. I just, you know, and it gives me goosebumps to think about it right now even. But then she took a deep breath, and I knew she was okay. But I tell you what, not being able to sleep is a very, very serious problem to deal with, especially when you have got so many other things going on as well. All right, last of all, not quite last, but next to the last, thoughts of death or suicide attempts. Now, I know we've been taught that suicide is sin. I'm not going to make that judgment call. I'm going to leave that up to God. I certainly don't want to encourage anyone to commit suicide. It is such a permanent solution to a temporary problem. But on the other hand, like Carol described it, you know, I can't live and I'm not allowed to die. So any attempt or even talking of suicide is serious. Do not ignore it. And then last but certainly not least, aches or pains, headaches, cramps, or digestive problems without a clear physical cause and or that do not ease even with treatment. Now that's fairly frequent symptoms that we see, aches and pains that really is no explanation for. You just can't understand why the person can't get better, why the pain doesn't ease up when they do take pain medications or whatever. And so it's definitely a symptom of something deeper going on than just the surface things. I see that I'm not going to get nearly through all this information that I have. I think I'm going to read this story, and it's a little bit lengthy, but I think it illustrates something very well. And the thing I want to illustrate is how depression can affect family relationships. This is from the March 1997 Family Life. It's called A Daughter's Diary. It starts, the first entry is May 8, 1964. It says, "Dear Mama, today is my 10th birthday. I wished for a cake, but you didn't have time. Sister Emily made a card for me. That was what I got." Next entry is July 23rd, 1964. "Saturday means work, work. This morning I swept all the rooms upstairs. Then Emily told Mama I forgot the stairs, so I had to do that job yet. This afternoon I was helping make oats shocks out in the field. The sun was very hot. I then came in and made cold milk banana soup for supper. Mama said to Father that I made it too sweet. I wish I could do better, Jesus. Do you care about me?" January 12, 1965. "School is fun. Snow is here and we are in a new year. Mama sewed a new cap for me, a new covering. What a joy. I almost also got two nice vases and a book. I think Mama likes me a little, even if I burned the cake yesterday." Shouldn't children know that their parents love them, no matter what? Isn't that a child's right? August 19, 1965. "Applesauce day at our house. Father came in and said he sees I am a good helper, but Mama said, well, she is 11 and should be. I wish I'd be very old, at least 20, then I would know how to do everything. Mama says, keep busy, let's get done. I tried to work fast. Oh, my tired legs. Jesus, I looked at your stars from my bedroom window tonight. Look in at me with your kind eyes, please." September 30th, 1965. "Today in school, I felt sick. When I got home, I told Mama my stomach hurts. She said, forget it and bring me some apples to peel for dumplings. I threw up on the basement floor, washed it down quickly, but Emily told Mama. Mama told me to sit rest on the couch then. I slept for a long time and Mama brought me toast. I wish she would put her hand on my head, but thanks, Mama, for the toast." February 4th, 1966. "Soon I will be 12. I wish I could sew, but Mama says I am too sloppy and mess up the machine. Father says my oatmeal cookies are delicious. Mama says I added too much flour. Mama thinks she helps. My cousin Millie was here today. She said her mama thinks she helps her as much as a real maid. After she left, I told that to Mama and asked if I'm a good helper too. She answered that I'd better not get any notions that I'm so wonderful." June 7th, 1966. 12 isn't so grand. I have more jobs to do. I am dumb, awful dumb. But how could I have known to whip the cream before I added the sugar? I dumped it out and we didn't have more cream, so there was none for the pudding. Mama scolded me loudly and Emily pitied me. Dad said we can eat peaches with the pudding. Mama told him how hard I am to handle and that she can never tell me anything because I think I know it all. My heart hurts. I don't think I know a lot. I should have asked her to do it. I feel like crying. Jesus, are you looking down on me this day?" November 21st, 1966. "Today is Thanksgiving Day and we spent it at Grandpa's house. Mama talked kindly and smiled all day, so I was happy. We had a good turkey dinner and I didn't even have to help with the dishes. This was a beautiful day of my life." Then we skip to May 15, 1968. "I found my old diary again. I am now 14. I have a new baby sister named Eva since April 25th. She is so sweet. Emily and I do the work and we often have good talks together. From Emily and Cousin Millie, I get understanding. Mama rests a lot. She looks tired. Poor Mama, with someone like me in charge of her kitchen. There are diapers to fold and supper to cook. Dad and the boys will come to eat in an hour." November 29, 1968. "Today I went with Dad to make firewood. He sawed and I stacked it on the wagon. It was so peaceful back there in the bush. Dad did not talk much, but he told me when he saw a rabbit so I could see it too. My hands got wet and cold, but I wish it would have taken longer. Father never says he likes me, but I can feel it." March 6, 1969. Eva is almost a year old and such a dear. Today I went to the neighbor Elam's to help clean house for church. Clumsy as I am, I spilled my pail of water as I stepped down from the step stool. Elam Anna laughed kindly and helped me mop it up. Isn't she normal or what? I am 15 now and trying to learn to sew. I made a note here to add a little family anecdote. You know, irritability is one of the signs of depression. And I want you to understand that I'm not faulting Carol. But it wasn't until Mama got over the most severe depression that the children realized that this was not a normal state for someone to be in. And he just made the observation that he didn't realize that other people's mamas weren't like that either. That he, you know, he just figured everybody's mama was like that. So, do you get an idea of how corrosive this can be and how harmful and painful this can be to family members? Now, this child was 10 when she started writing this diary. And you can just feel the pain in what she writes. May 31st, 1970. Over a year passed now. Spring is here. For my 16th birthday, Emily baked me a cake. She is out of school now. Mama has two girls at home, but I guess Emily is the best of the two. The bread she baked yesterday was very, very splendid, and Mama told everyone who had baked it. I took another piece and chewed it slowly. I could not taste any different from mine, but I guess Mama must know. Emily saw me and whispered, "It's not better than yours." July 8, 1971. So here again, another year has passed. I'm writing this at Elam's house. I work there 3 days a week, as Emily can pretty well handle the work at home. I watched Dad working in the fields today, and he waved to me. Good old Dad. Mama, do you miss me? Elam's wife, Anna, praises me a lot. Does she mean what she says? Am I maybe all right after all? July 17th, 1972. Again, a year has passed. Dad and Mama are on a one-month trip to Ohio and Pennsylvania. They seem so far away from us, and I hope they will come home again safely. I've done some rebellious things in my past few years. I want to pray more and join the church. When I did something I shouldn't have, Mama got really upset, but Father looked sadly at me and says, "You can do better than that, I know." My heart softens on the spot. Mama makes me angry, and I talk back. Woe to me, O Lord, have mercy on me. August 20th, 1972. Our parents are back. Mama looked subdued and even smiled at me and said, "I see you took good care of everything around here." Later, I opened the window by my bed and cried, looking up to heaven. This time, my tears were tears of joy. September 16, 1972. Today, Emily told Mama that David Byler is interested in me. "Oh," Mama said, "does he realize how she is? If she does start seeing him, you and I will have to do all the work while she has her head up in the clouds. What decent boy would want such a careless girl?" On and on she went. I fled and almost felt it was not worthwhile to go on living. October 9, 1972. I am joining church. I hope God will have mercy on me, a poor sinner. I read in my Bible and try to do my best. I pray every morning before I go downstairs that Jesus will help me guard my tongue and make me obedient to Mama, whatever she asks of me. April 1st, 1973. I have now been baptized. I'm helping teacher Ada Fisher finish her term. In January, her co-teacher got sick and had to quit, so the school board asked me. I enjoy being with so many eager, bright-eyed little ones. May life be kind to them. July 2nd, 1973. David Byler has entered my life, and our first visits with each other are now history. I'm still amazed and nervous about it all. When will he discover what an awful girl I've been? Mama is very nice when he's here. Thinking back over the years, a part of me wonders if it really was my fault every time Mama said it was. June 12th, 1975. So here again, it's been almost two years has passed now. Mrs. David Byler writes in her neglected diary once more, "Yes, I am a married woman. This is a different life, a new beginning. There are lots of nice days, but of course, not all is smooth sailing. Sometimes I am too touchy about minor remarks. My self-worth has never been high. I want to be humble, but not so humble that it turns to self-pity. May I always be good to David. I often thank God for him. We live on a rented farm and very busy. Tonight we sat outside and ate popcorn. I talked a bit how it was when I lived at home and worked with Mama. I can see that David can't comprehend what I'm telling him. I want to stop looking back and move forward, accepting myself as I am. September 18, 1976, we have a baby boy named Matthew. Mama was here. She told me she's busy since Emily got married too. Mama, Mama, how my heart aches for you. I wish so we could have been closer. I've come to the realization that most other mothers and their daughters are close. Emily did tell me that Mama cried when I got married and moved away. Does she really love me and doesn't know how to show it? January 12, 1978. I now see Mama occasionally. I go home for the day now and then. If I get behind with my work and ask for Sister Eva to help me out a bit, Mama gets upset. I struggle to be a sincere Christian. Our new baby Emily sleeps during the day. Nights, not so much. April 7, 1980. Today was Mama's funeral. No, it cannot be. A sudden illness and death. My own Mama? Surely not. There were words. I wanted to speak to her yet. Advice I needed from her. I am numb and weary. Lord, I need my old bedroom window tonight. June 4th, 1980. A long, sad summer. My own Mama is gone. Just gone. Eva does the housework for Father. My dear little brothers have all grown up. Today Father was here. He talked a lot. I'm to get Mama's special chest. David and I have three children. Baby Elaine arrived last week. Matthew is almost four, and little boy antics abound. Emily tags along and helps Matthew plenty. September 17, 1980. The little ones are napping. Yes, all three. I decided to move some of our things into Mama's chest. I expected it to be empty, but it wasn't. I can't write more now, for I am flooded with waves of tears and memories. October 24, 1980. In my chest, I found a quilt. It was a labor of love from Mama. When I left home, I wanted a rose and gray quilt, but Mama said, no. Here before me was my dream quilt. There was a note pinned on a gray square which has released me to live again. Dear daughter, this quilt is for you after I am gone. Accept it and know that I have always loved you. Years ago, I had nerve problems. Remember our trip? I am sorry that I am as I am. Live for Jesus, and please forgive me. Love, Mama. You get the idea how damaging untreated depression can be. Now, granted, this started back in 1964. I was in 1W service in 1968 to 1970, and it was only then that they were starting to develop antidepressants. They had lots of tranquilizers, big gun tranquilizers, but very few antidepressants. Much progress has been made in the years since then. And there is, I think the statistics indicate that at least 88% of people who suffer from depression can be helped. I want to say one thing yet about electroconvulsive therapy. Sometimes when people with depression are so depressed that they're suicidal, they're a danger to themselves, the last recourse is electroconvulsive therapy, shock treatments, if you will. I prefer to call it electroconvulsive therapy because it doesn't have the, you know, it doesn't sound as bad. And I'm not trying to gloss over anything, but it gives it a different light. Here's a book written by Martha Manning. Martha Manning was a practicing psychologist. She's a doctor of psychology. And she became severely depressed. The only thing that kept her from committing suicide is she knew what it would do to her daughter. She ended up having shock treatments. And this book, it is not for just general reading. There are some four-letter words that I would just as soon not become part of anyone's vocabulary. But You are mature adults. You can read with open eyes, and well, you know what I'm getting at. I just can't say it. Just because someone has to have shock treatments doesn't mean that it's the end of the world or the end of the road. It could very well be a new beginning, and it could very well be the difference between life and death. There's much that could be said. I haven't even gotten into some of the scriptures that I wanted to look at. I want one especially comes from Psalms. I've got it written down, but as a father pitieth his children, so our Heavenly Father pitieth us. There's also one in Job where he talks, well, Eliphaz the Temanite had just accused him of being unrighteous, how he sent widows away empty, and he took advantage of the weak and the poor and so on. And Job said, it's not true, but I do know one thing, that when I'm tried, I will come forth as gold. And I think that if we are tried, we can know that we will come forth as gold if we respond appropriately. Now, I don't want to give you the idea that I think God allows these things to happen because he wants to make us better. But we live in a sin-cursed earth. And these things, I know that all these things are in God's control. But there are some things I simply cannot explain. But I don't want to accuse God of doing things which I really don't think are in his nature. So, anyone have any questions? Anything that you didn't understand? Or I know it's past time to quit. I have skipped a lot of the material. Harry. Yeah.
You know what that is. You don't know it. You know where to get it. You know, you can learn it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what the symptoms are. You know when it needs to be applied and how to apply. What is first responder training for mental illness? What are the tools? What are the symptoms? You know, and this now is what needs to be done. And why is this?
Well, I don't think there is any training for first responders as far as mental illness is concerned. However, if a patient is suicidal, obviously the first order of business is to protect the patient from himself. And sometimes that takes the help of emergency medical services. None of us here are qualified to deal with full-blown depression. Now, we can deal with some of the less serious illnesses, but we are not qualified to deal with serious depression. That requires the help of a professional who has been trained and who understands. And I'd like to say this. Sometimes we have to treat the depression before thought processes will come back, before the suicidal thought processes will go away. And another thing I might mention here, and that is that when they start getting better, they start recovering and start not feeling quite so depressed anymore, that is also a critical time for suicide. Because they, you know, before they didn't have the energy to be able to even, or couldn't even think about how to kill themselves because they were too profoundly depressed. But once they start getting better, then that is a critical time in suicide prevention. I don't know if I gave you a satisfactory answer or not, Harry. Anyone else? Well, I think it's late enough. We need to bring this to a close, and I'll let James take care of that.